If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. In the 13th century, the Mongols masterminded one of the most extraordinary campaigns of conquest in all of history. Within just a few decades, these nomadic warriors had established the largest contiguous empire the world had ever seen, one that stretched from the borders of Hungary all the way to the East China Sea. The question is, how? For our latest Everything You Wanted to Know episode, Spencer Mizen sat down with Nicholas Morton, author of The Mongol Storm, Making and Breaking Empires in the Medieval Near East, to tackle your questions on the Mongols.
So, Nick, the Mongols, we've all heard of them. We're all familiar with the stories of their extraordinary campaigns of conquest, of their brilliant horsemanship, and of course, their fearsome historical reputation for brutality and destruction. But before diving deeper into all of that, I wonder if you could give us a quick introduction to the Mongol Empire. What were the main milestones in its meteoric rise and its eventual fall?
If you can sort of build up a picture of the Eurasian continent, in the centre of it, there is a huge area of grassland. And it's not solely grassland, there's forests and there's mountains. But for thousands of miles, there is a huge expanse of grassland that is very suitable for pastoral nomadic communities. And every now and again, in the history of the last couple of thousand years, those nomadic communities from time to time grouped together to form a coalition, and then they made war against one of the more predominantly agricultural societies around their margins. And that could be places like China or the Muslim world or Western Christendom. And so you've got the invasions of peoples like the Huns or the Seljuk Turks, and then you have the Mongols. And so in some respects, this is an ongoing, it's a reoccurring phenomenon. And the Mongol Empire is by far and away the most successful and largest of any of these empires originating from the Central Asian steppe region in history. And so the Mongol Empire, it was, again, a coalition formed under the rulership of Chinggis Khan. And in 1206, he believed himself to have acquired a mandate from heaven, a mandate that meant the Mongol people had a right, as far as he believed, to rule the entire world. From that point, the Mongol armies then began to conquer territories and regions around their margins, most famously areas of northern China, as well as other empires such as the Kara Khitai. And then in 1218, following a border incident at the town of Atra, the Mongols then began a series of campaigns that would see them conquer much of the Near East. And then through the 1220s, 1230s, particularly in the 1230s, the Mongols expanded across what was left of the central Eurasian steppe into the Rus principalities, and then ultimately to the borders of Western Christendom, where in 1241, they staged a major invasion of Hungary and Poland before withdrawing. So the Mongol Empire expanding enormously across the early years of the 13th century, and for a time at least, it really does seem as if the Mongols are going to conquer every scrap of land they come into contact with. And of course, I've just sort of briefly outlined the territorial extent of their conquests, but beyond the territorial borders, you've got supply chains, economic and commercial networks that go far beyond those borders as merchants and travellers from across the continent travel to the Mongol court to sell their wares or to conduct diplomacy with the Mongol Khan. You have those who have submitted or who pay tribute from territories far, far, far beyond those borders. And the Mongols tried expeditions as far as into Southeast Asia, as well as other parts of the world as well. So the Mongol Empire is truly vast. Now, you asked for the turning points. One of the key factors here is that when you've got an empire that's just that large, that raises all sorts of questions. I'm going to come back to this in a bit, actually, about how do you rule that? How do you make that work, given that your borders are, in many cases, several thousand miles from your capital? And so the way Chinggis Khan did this was to parcel out large areas of territory to his sons and to his sons' families, and they then handed these lands down to their successors. And these lands weren't theirs to own. They were held as, they're called ulus, sort of areas entrusted, areas of responsibility for that particular son and then that son's dynasty. But as with family politics the world over, siblings aren't famous for being able to share power. And so inevitably, over time, tensions became wars, and ultimately those various ulu became empires in their own right. And so the Mongol Empire began to break up, and the conquests ceased, not least because the Mongols were turning their armies on themselves. And increasingly, those various sub-empires, which are still very large empires by any other standard, they begin to take on much more the sort of the culture and, in some cases, the religion of the peoples that they rule. And so they become sort of culturally distinctive from one another. So the Mongol Empire in China begins to look very different to, say, the Mongol Empire in the Near East. And so the Mongol Empire ultimately sort of merges with its environment to a great degree. And that really is when the Mongol Empire, as a distinctive phenomenon, begins to fade, really.
Thank you for that. That was a really good overview of the empire. And now I'm going to turn to a question which has been submitted on social media from AgroBioDiverse. That question is, were all Mongols pastoralists or did some practice settled agriculture? And I wonder if I just expand on that a little bit to ask you, what did Mongol communities, Mongol society look like before their extraordinary campaigns of conquest?
So Mongol society was overwhelmingly nomadic. There are various communities, sort of hunter-gatherer communities, but also some agricultural communities, either in the steppe region or around its margins, and they had dealings with the Mongols. And so it's the environment itself does include a diversity of different sort of ways of life, but the Mongols do overwhelmingly seem to have been nomadic. And their way of life would have involved, when they weren't waging campaigns, obviously, would have involved travelling from grazing area to grazing area. Often these are defined by season, so specific sort of winter grazing grounds and summer grazing grounds, depending on the climate and the weather and the availability of forage and things like that. And those communities would have consisted of wagons. So you'd have a large Mongol community would have several hundred, possibly several thousand wagons, on the tops of which would have been their tents made from felt. And so when they got to the next grazing ground, the wheels would have been taken off the wagons, the tents would have been brought down from the wagons, and then the camp would be set up, often in strict sort of precedence and seniority. It's not a random layout of tents. They've got a very clearly defined social structure, which is reflected in the layout of the tents. And that essentially is the sort of the bedrock of their society. And of course, during the day, people would ride and hunt and corral their livestock, whether that's sheep or goats or horses, and that's their way of life. One of the interesting dimensions to this is that whilst the men do the bulk of the fighting, women are also trained to fight and ride as well, and sometimes they do. But the primary role taken by Mongol women is in the management of these vast tent cities. So while the Mongol men are off with the livestock or fighting wars, the actual encampments, which can encompass tens, sometimes hundreds of thousands of people, they are managed specifically by the elite Mongol women of that particular dynastic group. Over time, however, that begins to change. So take that as sort of the basic model. But as the Mongols conquer territory after territory and become wealthy in ways that pretty much any other civilization of this era could scarcely imagine, those tents get pretty seriously upgraded. They get large enough to hold thousands of people in some cases. They're made from incredible fabrics, from silks, from brocade. We even hear reports of the nails used to hold the textiles to the tent poles being made out of gold. So there is very much a step change in sort of the luxury nomadic encampments of the later decades as opposed to the traditional ones of their origins.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger. Talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're working out or working on your high score, you never settle for less. So why should it be any different when you choose your protein drink? Rockin' Protein comes in three delicious flavors, has 30 grams of protein, and is always made with fresh milk, so you're never left with that chalky taste. Rockin' Protein. Never settle for less than a great-tasting, high-quality protein drink. Visit rockinprotein.com to find Rockin' Protein wherever you are. Rockin' Protein and Shamrock Farms are registered trademarks of Shamrock Foods Company.
Great stuff. Now I'm going to move on to a question from Bianco Basso, and that is, what motivated their expansion? So, I mean, it's a good question, because what turned what previously would have been quite small-scale sort of expansions into this you know, this incredible world-changing event.
Well, as I mentioned, it's, you know, there are plenty of occasions in the past where confederations of peoples in the Central Asian steppe formed and then waged war on the various societies around their margins. But this one goes some way beyond it. But it's not just about what motivated Genghis Khan to stage that invasion. Many people throughout history have been motivated to invade their neighbours. It's also how do you galvanise such vast numbers of people to share that vision of global conquest, the entire planet under Mongol rule. And for many years, that didn't seem too far-fetched as an objective. The key moment seems to have been that Genghis Khan believed himself in 1206 to have received a mandate from Tengri. Now, sometimes Tengri is translated as God. Its meaning is the eternal sky. It's a sort of spiritual presence. And he feels that he received, not just for himself, but also for his people, the Mongol people, a mandate from heaven. So this is a spirit-led mandate to rule the planet as he understands it. And that message seems to have been enormously powerful and was taken incredibly seriously. That the Mongol people do have not just the right, but a spiritual obligation to bring the world into their hegemony, under their control. And that message seems to have galvanized tens, hundreds of thousands of people to pursue and enact that vision in practice.
So let's talk a little bit more about Genghis Khan then. He features pretty prominently on a popular search engine queries related to the Mongols. So what kind of person was he? I mean, how was he able to motivate this extraordinary event?
We hear lots of stories about him, but it's difficult to know which stories to take and which ones, you know, what to do with these stories, because they weren't written by him. They weren't necessarily written even by Mongol authors. In fact, very little was written by Mongol authors. The vast majority of the sources that we've got were written by other people. And of course, separating legend from reality is exceptionally difficult. But perhaps it's safe to say that Genghis Khan was raised in an environment where various different clans were at war with each other, and he himself was caught up in that violence from a very, very early age. And he went through several periods of major personal upheaval and captivity. He was sent into exile. So this is a very, very turbulent childhood. But nonetheless, he ultimately was able to weld these various Mongol groups into a confederation and to execute his vision. And there's no reason to disbelieve that the notion that he seriously believed that he did have this mandate from heaven. But at the very least, judging from his actions, this is clearly someone who has the ability to motivate and to draw together, whether by compulsion or inspiration or by any other means, enormous numbers of people, and for them to begin a global conquest. Now, he died long before the Mongol Empire reached its apogee. But nonetheless, even by that time, he had conquered a simply vast scope of territory. It's also safe to say that he was a very innovative thinker. He began to remodel Mongol society and to reconceptualize what it meant to be a Mongol so that he could create what would become, in practice, a very effective weapon of war. And so he didn't restrict being a Mongol simply to Mongol people, but he enrolled people, sometimes by choice, sometimes by force, into Mongol society, and either enabled them or forced them to act as Mongols. And of course, with every new addition, the Mongol Empire's armies grow larger and larger. So he clearly was someone with a very powerful vision and a very strong ability to communicate that vision to his followers and to other peoples. And needless to say, his powers as a commander and as a warrior were also clearly incredibly powerful as well, given the sheer range of societies that he met in battle and overcame in battle. So we are absolutely talking about someone with exceptional personal qualities, although before it sounds like I'm praising him too much, it should also be pointed out that the body count from his career would have been truly enormous as well. So my particular area of study is the Mongols in the Near East. And I think for me, at least, the two people I would want to draw attention to, really, are the first is a Mongol commander called Chomakun, who in 1230 led a large Mongol force into the Near East. Now, parts of the Near East had submitted sort of temporarily to the Mongols previously, but he enforced that dominion and then brought the conquest that much further. And unlike many Mongol armies, he didn't actually have that many troops, and he managed to conquer vast swathes of the Near East and very much set up Mongol rule in that area, particularly in what would be Persia in that period, but also the Caucasus. So today that would be sort of Azerbaijan, Armenia, Georgia, that sort of area. Another Mongol leader who's also incredibly influential in that region was called Hulagu, and he was the brother of the great Khan Monka. And he was sent in 1252 to expand still further Mongol dominion in the Near East. And he, in 1256, his forces reached the region, and they overthrew the strongholds of the Nizaris, who are often known as the Assassins, in Persia. And he's also famous or infamous for his conquest of the city of Baghdad, one of the largest cities anywhere in the world at this time. And that's a conquest that caused the deaths of tens, hundreds of thousands of people. Following that, Hulagu then invaded into northern Syria, where he conquered cities like Aleppo. But crucially, something else that makes his career so important is that it was also under his reign that the Mongol invasions in the Near East came to a close, because it was in 1260 that the Mamluk Empire, so it's a Muslim empire in Egypt, marched out to fight Hulagu's forces and successfully defeated a Mongol garrison at the battle called Ain Jalut. And this is a key moment. Mongols don't tend to get defeated, so this is a key moment for the ceasing of the Mongol advance. And it's also under Hulagu that civil wars began to break out with other Mongol leaders elsewhere, which again had the effect of stalling the Mongol advances. So those, for me, for the Mongols in the Near East, are two crucial figures, both for the expansion but also for the halting of the Mongol invasions in that region.
Great. Now, I've got two questions here that I'm going to bundle up into one. The first is from Gareth Rees-Collins, and that is, how superior was the Mongols' archery skills compared with their European contemporaries? And Denise Davidson asks, how were Mongols able to exploit the use of the horse to their advantages? So, yeah, I mean, to forge an enormous empire, you obviously have to be pretty skilled at the art of war. Can you tell us, you know, what gave the Mongols the edge in this respect?
Yes, absolutely. So, I mean, one of the traditional advantages of nomadic communities from the Central Asian steppe is that they are born and raised in the saddle with a bow in their hand. So they are exceptionally capable archers. It's simply part of their lifestyle. It's not something they learn as a trade or learn as something when they're grown up. It's just part of the culture right from childhood. So they are exceptional archers. And in battle, like many nomadic peoples from the Central Asian steppe, their great skill is massed archery. So you might get a squadron of, say, 1,000 Mongol horse who would gallop up to within 50 or 60 metres of an opposing force, loose a few volleys of arrows, and then wheel away before any counterattack can appear. And you keep doing that. And you keep doing that until the enemy is so worn down that it breaks or does something stupid, and then the Mongols have got them where they want them, essentially. So these are traditional tactics, but the Mongols have some very, very effective commanders who are very good at amplifying the effect of that archery. And so we hear about them making mannequins, so fake people, which they mount on horses, to give the impression that the Mongol army is, in fact, right in front of their opposing army, and then the Mongol army comes from the side. And so they've got some very advanced tactics, which they are very capable of using. They also occasionally use battlefield artillery to supplement their sort of heavy crossbows or catapults to supplement their archery, which too can be extremely effective in many of their battles. But the key tools of the Mongol war machine are the horse and the bow. It has to be said, the horses aren't particularly large. They're steppe ponies. The Mongols don't have stud farms as agricultural societies typically do. If you want to breed a big war horse, you need stud farms so that you can selectively breed them to make big, strong horses. But the Mongols don't have those sorts of stud farms. So typically a Mongol warrior would have 5 or 6 mounts beside him and would change mounts fairly quickly because the horses are going to get very tired because they're not that strong. But even so, with that number of mounts, the Mongols can be very, very manoeuvrable, and they're all mounted, typically. So the entire army can move, adapt, and adjust very quickly. And the Mongols are fairly hardy. They don't require much by way of logistics. Their wagon trains don't have to keep up with them the whole time. Now, their opponents, whether they're opponents from Western Europe or indeed many other parts of the world, they do have wagon trains. They've got infantry, and they're not nearly as hardy. So they've got to move much more slowly. And they've got these long lines of logistics, which are very easy for the Mongols to cut. So these are all weaknesses which the Mongols' mobility enables them to exploit. On the question of archery, of course, the Mongols are not the only civilization in the world at this time who rear their children to shoot bows or other ranged weapons. Most societies will raise their children to shoot some kind of ranged weapon, whether it's a slingshot or a light bow or a long bow or other such weapons. And so many agricultural societies were capable of offering, returning fire, shooting back when the Mongols shot at them. And the Mongols seem to have been particularly, several sources said the Mongols were fairly nervous fighting large formations of crossbows. In fact, when a papal legate went to visit the Mongols, partly to conduct diplomacy, although, of course, he was also trying to sort of work out how their war machine worked and therefore how to break it. He came back, one of his top tips for any commander in future marching to fight the Mongols was to equip themselves with crossbows. Because something that armies, particularly armies such as in the Crusader States, were very good at was to equip themselves with very, very large shields, about the size of a good-sized table in modern-day parlance, as it were. And they'd line these huge shields up, and the crossbowmen would then shoot through the gaps. It's a very hard formation for the Mongols to break, and crossbows have a long range. The disadvantage of the crossbow, of course, is that you can only shoot maybe 1 or 2 bolts a minute, and it'll be less than that if you're manoeuvring at the same time, whereas the Mongols, even if they are manoeuvring, can loose 5, 6, 7, possibly more arrows in a minute. So the Mongols have a very faster rate when it comes to shooting arrows. Whereas crossbows, on the other hand, have very strong penetrative power. There's no armour around in this era that can stop a crossbow bolt. And that would also go some way to explaining why the Mongols were nervous of soldiers armed with crossbows.
Now, the Mongols have, as I mentioned it at the beginning of the interview, a fearsome reputation for brutality and destruction. And that kind of leads me on to the next question we've had submitted on social media from somebody called Sean. He asks, were the Mongols really as destructive of towns and cities as popular history has traditionally portrayed them to be? Or has history given them a little bit of a rough deal?
The Mongols were described, even at the time of their invasions, by many societies as being incredibly brutal. Many people described them in sort of along the stereotype of the barbarian and things like that. And seeing as they were on the receiving end of the Mongol attacks, you can kind of understand where they're coming from. But on the other hand, if you look at the Mongols more sort of dispassionately, the Mongols are not indiscriminate in their violence. They're not simply attacking anything that moves. There is a logic to what they're doing, even if the body count is fairly considerable. And the logic goes something like this. If you submit to the Mongols and acknowledge that they have a right to rule the world, then the Mongols will leave you alone. In fact, they might even praise you, particularly if you acknowledge that before their armies are hovering on your frontier, because they can say, well, this person or this people has recognized our right to rule the world. We haven't threatened them, they've recognized it, which of course is a very powerful thing for them to be able to say. If, however, the Mongols have to induce you to submit, should we say, whether that is by threats or ultimately the invasion of Mongol armies, you haven't recognized that. And so the Mongols would be much less gentle. And certainly cities that hold out against the Mongols, they almost inevitably are massacred by the Mongol armies because the Mongols want to send a very clear message to anyone else who resists in the future that this is what happens if you resist the Mongols and their rights to rule the world.
Can you give us a couple of really egregious examples of that in action?
For me, studying the history of the Mongols in the Near East, it's the conquest of Baghdad. I mean, the loss of life there is truly appalling, with vast numbers of people being killed. But even there, it's although the numbers killed are enormous, it's a truly appalling massacre. The Mongols are not simply, I don't know, the stereotype of the barbarian horde unleashed. They're very systematic about it. Different districts of the city were assigned to different commanders. There were certain communities in Baghdad that were protected and supposed to be left alone. And so even though the violence is incredibly intense, it is not unrestrained violence. There is a guiding hand to it, even if that is obviously no consolation to the many, many people who were killed in that process. Another example of this is a much earlier example when the Mongols were besieging a stronghold, I think it's in Khurasan, in northern Persia, which would today probably be the northern Iran or sort of the southern Stans, as it were. And in this siege, there was a relative of Chinggis Khan among the Mongol besiegers, and that relative was killed as part of the fighting. Now, resisting the Mongols and refusing to submit to them was seen to be a very serious crime, a very serious problem by the Mongols. Killing a member of Chinggis Khan's family, that is a much bigger deal even so. And so the Mongols are famously decreed that because of that, not only would the garrison and everyone inside the walls of that stronghold be killed, but every living thing, down to the last bird, would be killed in the surrounding area, just to make the point that this community had not merely resisted the Mongols and their perceived rights to rule the world, but they had dared to harm a member of Chinggis Khan's family, and so the consequences are that much higher.
Now, this leads us on to the next question, which has been sent in by Quinn Buabsa Marriott on social media, and that is, was apocalypticism used intentionally as a fear tactic by the Mongols? So I guess the question here is, did the Mongols' fearsome reputation strike some kind of terror-induced paralysis in their opponents? Was it a useful weapon of war?
So, just take the word apocalypticism. The Mongols didn't claim the end of the world was coming, and so they didn't place themselves in an end times narrative. Having said that, they did see what they were doing in a spiritual sense, and so doubtless they would see it as a crucial moment in the history of the human species that now the Mongols have been given control over the world, so it would still be a landmark event in human history. But yes, there are many peoples who see the Mongols in an apocalyptic way, and we have writers from both Christian and Muslim traditions speculating about whether what they're seeing is in fact the armies of the Antichrist, and there are many authors who wonder if the Mongols are in some way related. And again, you find this both in the Christian and Muslim tradition, to the peoples of Gog and Magog, who, according to religious text, are peoples who in the end of the world will be released from the gates of the north to wreak havoc upon the peoples of the world. And so there's a lot of speculation. Are the Mongols the peoples of Gog or Magog? Many people reach the conclusion that they're not, but they're very closely related in some way, shape, or form. So there's a lot of apocalyptic speculation around the Mongols. But to take the second part of your question, yes, absolutely. Terror is arguably the Mongols' most powerful weapon of war, and they deliberately take strides to amplify it. And so, for example, we hear in some regions, whenever the Mongols killed 1,000 people, they would impale the corpse of one of those people and suspend that corpse on a large spear. And so anyone travelling through that area would know that 1,000 people had been killed there. Now, there's only one reason to do that, and that is to spread terror among the people, anyone else who still hasn't submitted yet. And of course, envoys traveling to the Mongols would pass through these deserted settlements with piles of bodies or subsequently piles of skeletons with a suspended corpse, and they would know what that meant. And so having seen several hundred of such settlements and then reached the Mongol court, well, that's going to put your diplomacy in a specific light, isn't it, if that's the case? So yeah, the Mongols do use terror as a weapon of war, and it could induce paralysis. And there's a Muslim author called Ibn al-Athir, very observant historian who lived through the early years of the Mongol invasions. And he reported many stories of the Mongol invasions. And on one occasion, he said that he'd heard that a single Mongol horseman could go into a village and order the inhabitants of that village to line up. And then he'd go down the line and just kill them one by one. No one dared resist, no one dared flee, because they were simply frozen with terror. Now, whether that's strictly true or a traveller's tale, I can't tell you. There's quite a few stories like that. And I think perhaps on a more sort of geopolitical level, there seem to be lots of occasions when armies which have been formed to fight the Mongols are quite honestly just beginning to back away from the battle even before it started, because they've got a pretty good idea about how this is going to go, and it's not going to go in their favour, because it's never gone in anyone's favour except the Mongols.
Okay, so here's a question from Susie Q, who asks, how far did the Mongols get into Europe, and how real was the prospect that they could have gotten much further?
Okay, good question. So they got into what today would be modern-day Poland, defeating every army sent against them, and into Hungary, defeating every army sent against them, and they began to advance sort of into the borderlands of Austria before they withdrew. And so there's several factors here. Perhaps the most prescient is no one in Eastern Europe defeated the Mongols at all. They won every battle. And so on the battlefield, it does seem as if there's just no prospect of stopping them. The papacy raised a crusade to go and fight the Mongols, although whilst there may have been a few skirmishes between some advanced troops, there was no major battle. So we don't know how that battle would have gone, but seeing as the Mongols defeated every other army from Western Christendom, there's every reason to believe it may not have fared that well. So the Mongols then withdrew voluntarily from the region. There's questions around why they did that, but the basic point is that for decades, Western Christendom was acutely preoccupied with the question of when the Mongols would come back. And it seemed very likely they would, and the Mongols fully intended to. It wasn't as if they were sort of weighing up their alternatives. Yes, they absolutely intended to invade Western Christendom. And it seems as if in 1259, 1260, the Mongols were preparing the ground with a few sort of raids and reconnaissance missions for the full-scale invasion of Western Christendom. But notably, what happened at that same time is that other Mongol forces in the Near East, led by Hulagu, who I mentioned earlier, he began to assert himself as ruler of the Near East, and to the Mongols to the north, on the territories bordering Hungary and Poland, he got a man called Berke. He began to fear that his rights to the Near East, as he saw it, were being usurped by Hulagu to the south. And so Hulagu and Berke went to war with each other. And so these two formidable invasion armies, Hulagu's army in the Near East, Berke's in the north, rather than renewing their own invasions into Europe and what's left of the Near East, they turned on each other. And for decades, they fought campaign after campaign across the line of the Caucasus Mountains to assert their various perceived rights to different regions. So the invasion of Western Christendom never actually happened. But there is another factor to this as well, because people have wondered why the Mongol invasion stopped where they did. And in many areas, it's not armies that are stopping them, it's the landscape. The Mongols are a nomadic people. They need vast areas of grazing. And I mean, even an army of, say, 10,000 troops, which by Mongol standards isn't particularly large, it will still have vast herds of sheep and goats and horses, not to mention all the wagons they bring with them. And these animals all need grazing. And in some parts of what today be Eastern Europe, there is such grazing, and that's possible. But once you get into, the further you get west, you start to hit thick areas of deciduous forest and mountain, and it's much less conducive to those vast areas of grazing required by Mongol armies. So historians have speculated that even if the Mongols did invade Western Christendom, they may not have been successful, not because their armies would have been stopped in battle necessarily, but simply because their way of life couldn't continue in that region. And people have made similar arguments for Southeast Asia, because jungle regions and, again, thick forest, it's just not suitable for a nomadic way of life.
Now, let's step away from the war and conquest for a little bit and turn to a question which has been submitted by MHFQ, and that is, how is it possible to efficiently govern an empire the size of the one administered by the Mongols? So, also, what distinguished the Mongol state from its contemporaries, and what was it like to live under Mongol rule?
Well, they say about the Roman Empire that all roads lead to Rome. And with the rise of the Mongol Empire, it's a bit of a case that all roads have to reorientate themselves to point towards the huge encampments of the Mongol Empire's regional capitals, or indeed its main capital in Mongolia at Karakorum. And this happens for various reasons. Firstly, the Mongols are in charge. So if you want anything, you have to go to their courts to ask for it. And that goes for subjugated peoples, diplomats, and anyone else who wants to conduct politics. So you have to go to the Mongol enormous wagon cities in order to ask for these things. But also, there's commerce, because the Mongols have enriched themselves enormously with the wealth of many, many conquered civilizations. And that wealth is truly substantial. And those merchants want a slice of that wealth. Of course they do. That's what the merchants want. And so they will bring the Mongols whatever they want, because they know they're going to pay for it and can afford it. And so suddenly the commercial networks, the road layout of the area begins to rework itself to point at these big courts as the roads fill up with all these people heading in that direction. And in the same way, the pricing structure of goods changes. Because if the Mongols want something, they're going to have it. And so the price increases, even if it was little known as a commodity before that. So you need to imagine the entirety of Eurasia reworking itself, adjusting its networks to point at these big encampment cities all the way across its territory. So that's one really big change. But how do the Mongols coordinate all of this? Well, they try and cope with the distances to some degree by setting up what's called a fast horse system. And what that means is that if you want to get a message over, say, 1,000 miles of territory, you have a series of waypoints at regular intervals along the road. And a messenger will get onto a horse and gallop that horse to the next waypoint, give the message to the next messenger, who will then gallop onto the next waypoint and on until that messenger reaches the Mongol capital. And that's the fastest way they can transport a message, and it can cover, in that way, several hundred kilometres in a single day. So it is quite efficient, but the distances are still huge. The other way the Mongols try and do this, as I mentioned, is that they, in the early years, they parcel out large areas of the empire as ulu to be ruled by leading Mongol dynasties who will act as regional governors. They are answerable, in theory at least, to the Great Khan, whether the Great Khan is in Mongolia or on campaign. But if you can't rule an empire like this centrally. It's got to be done at a regional level, and they are the ones who will conduct the regional politics in this. And they will then liaise with the regional governors, the regional commanders. They will then sort out the taxation across the various Mongol districts and that kind of thing.
And am I right in saying that they had no compunction about uprooting groups of skilled workers and moving them vast distances across the empire to where they were most required?
No, absolutely not. The Mongols see the various peoples they've conquered. They're very keen to spare artisans. So artisanal families that have significant skills, particularly in things they want. So if you made jewellery or carpets or silks or tents or weapons, you're pretty safe. But that's no guarantee that you'll be left alone, as you say. I mean, for example, there's a group of German miners the Mongols caught in Hungary. And so they transported them all the way across to what today would be Kyrgyzstan and set them to work mining there because that's where they had a need for them. And so people are viewed very much as assets to be picked up and redeployed wherever the Mongols may happen to want them. And so there's no guarantee that you'll be able to stay in your hometown or anything like that. You'll be sent and you'll go where you're sent and that's it.
Now, what do we know about the Venetian merchant Marco Polo's interactions with the Mongols? How has his testimony shaped historical perceptions of them?
Yeah. So the Mongol Empire at its height extended from the Pacific seaboard all the way across to the Mediterranean, to the borders of Hungary and Poland. It's absolutely enormous. And whilst we've talked about the wars and threats that posed to the people who remained independent or indeed those subjugated by the Mongols, it also represents an opportunity because when civilizations such as the various Muslim societies of this era or peoples from Southeast Asia or Western Christendom, when they send out envoys to the Mongols, and they may go as far as Karakorum, the Mongol capital in Mongolia, they're not just acting as ambassadors. They're going to places that their civilizations have never heard of before. Western Christendom had never gone to Karakorum, or at least there was no report of them having done so, and there's no memory of it. The sources don't remember a time when anyone went that far. So for many of these societies, doing diplomacy or trading with the Mongols is opening up new areas for them to explore and to do business with. Now, that's not to say the Mongol Empire became this massive free trade zone. The Mongols encouraged trade, but they also fought lots of wars against themselves, so which would have made the roads perilous from time to time. But there are opportunities for merchants, travellers, and later on missionaries or sort of representatives of different religions to travel across the entire continent. And when they return home, they will bring home stories of unfamiliar places, or animals that their society had never been aware of before, or birds, or landscapes, or objects, or trade goods. And so you need to imagine all these people returning home and telling their families and friends about what they've experienced. And these experiences are new in many cases. And so the Mongol Empire represents a time when people learn a great deal more about Eurasia than they ever had previously. And sometimes they return not just with stories and trade goods, but with new technologies as well. Gunpowder begins to spread very rapidly towards the end of the 13th century, and it seems very likely that Mongol merchants or travellers who had been to the Mongols played a role in disseminating that technology, which will change the world in later decades. And of course, for different religions, it opened up opportunities for missionaries and representatives from various different religions to seek new believers in other parts of Eurasia as well. Now, for Marco Polo specifically, he's a merchant. And that is very clear from his writings because as he goes from city to city, region to region, he's always very careful to point out what are the particularly good items to buy from that city. So if you go there, there's really good carpets. If you go there, there's really good minerals. If you go there, but of course, as soon as he comes back to Western Christendom and tells people about this, people begin to see opportunities. There is money to be made out there as they see it. There are people to be approached about religion and Christianity of Western Christendom. And the same is true for other civilizations elsewhere. They have their own Marco Polos, if you like, who do the same thing. And so the world the Mongols create is a much more connected world, not because they intended to create a much more connected world, but that is the outcome nonetheless.
Great stuff. Now I'm going to turn to a question from Tony Latimaki, which is, can you tell us about the Mongols' defeats? Who beat them? When, where, how, and why? And I guess behind this question is, how did it all come to an end for the Mongol Empire?
So the trick is not to defeat the Mongols, but to defeat them consistently, and that's a very big ask. And again, focusing on my own area of specialisation, which is the Near East, the civilization which did prove able to defeat the Mongols was the Mamluk Empire of Egypt. They defeated a Mongol garrison in 1260 at the Battle of Ain Jalut, which was significant, partly because they defeated the Mongols, but also because the Mongols didn't counter-strike hard enough afterwards. And so for almost 20 years, the Mongols, that defeat hung in the air because the Mongols weren't able to strike back in force against the Mamluks. And this also shows the compounding influence of the Mongols' own civil wars, which break out during that 20-year interval, which inhibits the Mongols from responding. But in 1281, the Mongols do attack against the Mamluks once again, and they are again defeated by the Mamluks. So it's not just the Mamluks' ability to defeat the Mongols, but their ability to build up a track record of defeats. That's when the House of Cards begins to totter. Because if you are a subjugated personal people under Mongol rule and someone defeats the Mongols, you probably won't rebel if the Mongols get defeated once. But if the Mongols get defeated consistently, then you might start to think to yourself, well, actually, maybe this is possible. And from what I've seen from my period at least, rebellions rarely happen when the tyranny is at its greatest, when the repression is at its worst. Rebellions happen when rebellions are plausible. And so if it can be plausibly shown that Mongol rule can be contested, then you get the multiplier effect of other people thinking, well, if they can do it, perhaps so can I.
And finally, Nick, here's a question from Robert Keynes, and that is, how did the Mongols change world history? And that's obviously a very big question. But if you could pull out one salient way in which they changed or transformed Eurasia, what would it be?
First, can I just acknowledge the scale of the question? I mean, the Mongol impact on Eurasia was truly profound in so many ways, shapes, and forms. And for those conquered by the Mongols and the trauma of that, that will affect not just their history, but also their historical memory. So the way that they think about themselves, the traumas of the past, that can influence the people's identity right up to the present day. But even those who weren't conquered by the Mongols could still be profoundly affected by them. I mean, to give you one very small example of this, even in areas as far-flung and remote as the Kingdom of England, the Mongols had an impact, even though they never came within hundreds of miles, possibly over 1,000 miles of the Kingdom of England. And so, for example, in East Anglia, so the eastern part of the Kingdom of England, there's lots of fishing families who brought in one year an enormous haul of herring. And they were very pleased with this because they thought, okay, so when the German merchants come and buy the herring from us, we will have made a nice amount of money. But the German merchants never arrived because the German merchants were too afraid to leave their homes because they feared that a new Mongol offensive might sweep in while they're away. And so as a result, the Kingdom of England had an enormous surplus of herring. Now, that's a tiny episode, and of course, in terms of impact, it's slight. But my point is that the Mongol expansion sent out shockwaves that went far beyond the borders of their empire. So even those peoples who were only very lightly affected by the Mongols, it still forms part of their identity, part of their historical memory, part of how they remember who they are. And even those people who aren't conquered, they still fear or feared that they weren't, that they would be conquered. And that too plays a role in their thought world and their decision making. But just stepping back from the military area, I've mentioned already how connected the Mongol Empire made Eurasia, so I'll leave that. I think for me, one of the major areas that I find truly fascinating is the knowledge exchange. I've mentioned that the rise of the Mongol Empire seems to be connected to the dissemination of gunpowder technology from China, but other technologies are changing hands at this time. New fabrics, the Mongols experiment with the use of paper money in parts of the Near East, which is a practice from China, but they try and use it in the Near East, fails spectacularly. But nonetheless, they're trying it. So suddenly new ideas and new technologies begin to appear where previously they hadn't. Many of them are from China, but there are others from other places as well. And so suddenly, when you read the stories written, for example, in Western Christendom in the 14th century, they're talking in these stories about commodities that previously would have been unheard of, things like parrot feathers and that sort of thing, because suddenly the world has opened up in a way it hadn't done previously. And the same is true for other civilizations across the continent. Another thing which research is increasingly beginning to show, which is perhaps one of the darker sides of that exchange of ideas and technologies, is that, of course, when human beings exchange things, whether that's money or goods or ideas, they can also exchange their diseases, their parasites, and things like that. And so will the animals with them. And so research is increasingly suggesting that the Mongols and the expansion of the Mongol Empire across Eurasia was also one of the major vectors for the transmission of the Black Death, which in some regions would bring about a total loss of population of between a half and two-thirds of total population. And that's true in many areas across Eurasia, in the Near East, in Central Asia, in other parts of the world as well. And people are even beginning to wonder if it spread into parts of Africa as well. There's lots of very interesting research being done on that. But when things change hands, those things can be both things that you intend to exchange and things you don't.
That was Nicholas Morton. The Mongol Storm, Making and Breaking Empires in the Medieval Near East, is published by Basic Books. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.
A collision between a Chinese jet and an American spy plane.
He came and rammed into our left wing.
With relations increasingly strained, what are the chances of things spinning out of control?
The Western world was asleep.
I'm Gordon Carrera. I'll be exploring the friction in this most important of relationships and asking, has the West taken its eye off the ball?
You cannot ignore China.
From BBC Radio 4, this is Shadow War, China and the West. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.